Welcome to the top-line data announcement of CHAPTER-1, a phase II clinical study of deucrictibant for the prophylactic treatment of hereditary angioedema. My name is Maggie Beller, Head of Communications at Pharvaris. Please note that today's webcast is being recorded, and the slides will be uploaded onto the investor section of our corporate website immediately following this call. Please note that the statements of our guests today are their own and not those of Pharvaris, and Pharvaris makes no representation as to the adequacy, fairness, accuracy, or completeness of the information in their comments. In addition, our presentation today will include forward-looking statements, including but not limited to statements regarding deucrictibant and its potential, as well as our preclinical and clinical studies, regulatory interactions, and future plans. Such forward-looking statements are subject to certain risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results to differ materially from those projected. For additional information regarding the various factors that could cause such differences, please see the section entitled Risk Factors in our annual report on Form 20-F and our other filings available on the SEC's website. In addition, any forward-looking statements represent the company's expectations only as of today. While we may elect to update these forward-looking statements, we specifically disclaim any obligation to do so unless required by law. During our call, Pharvaris' Chief Executive Officer, Berndt Modig, will speak to Pharvaris' continued journey to pioneer science for patient choice. Next, Pharvaris' Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Peng Lu, will go through the top-line efficacy, safety, and safety findings from our CHAPTER-1 study. We're also joined by Dr. Mark Riedl, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego, clinical director of the U.S. HAEA Angioedema Center, and a principal investigator in the CHAPTER-1 study, who will share his perspective on these data as a worldwide recognized expert treating physician. Thank you, Dr. Riedl, for joining us. Additionally, Pharvaris' Chief Community Engagement and Commercial Officer, Wim Souverijns, and Chief Business Officer, Morgan Conn, are available for the Q&A portion of the call. Berndt?
Thank you, Maggie. First, I'd like to start by sincerely thanking all the clinical trial participants and their caregivers, the site investigators and staff, the HAE community, and the Pharvaris team for the contributions to the CHAPTER-1 study. People living with HAE want a therapy that delivers it all: injectable-like efficacy, a well-tolerated safety profile that is also easy to administer. We believe that deucrictibant has the potential to deliver on their hopes. Today marks an important milestone for the HAE community. For the first time ever, bradykinin B2 receptor antagonism has been shown to be an effective mechanism in the prevention of HAE attacks. With that, I'd like to hand it over to our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Lu, to walk through the CHAPTER-1 data. Peng?
Thank you, Berndt. I'm very happy to share with you the top-line results of the CHAPTER-1 phase II study evaluating deucrictibant for the prophylactic treatment of HAE. Today, we are thrilled that the study met its primary endpoint. Compared to placebo, deucrictibant statistically and clinically significantly reduced the monthly attack rate by 84.5%. In addition, deucrictibant demonstrated a 92.3% reduction in the occurrence of moderate and severe attacks and a 92.6% reduction in occurrence of attacks treated with on-demand medication. Overall, clinically meaningful improvements are observed across primary, secondary, and also health-related quality of life assessment with deucrictibant treatment in the study. For the safety profile, deucrictibant was also well-tolerated at both dose levels. Deucrictibant is the first potential HAE treatment to combine injectable-like efficacy, favorable safety profile, and the compelling convenience of an oral treatment. CHAPTER-1 study is a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled phase II study. In total, 34 patients are enrolled from nine countries in North America and Europe. They were randomized to receive either placebo or one of the dose levels of deucrictibant, 20 milligrams per day or 40 milligrams per day, for 12 weeks of treatment. The open-label portion of the CHAPTER-1 study is still ongoing at the 40 milligrams per day dose. Today, the top-line presentation will focus on double-blind phase. Of the 34 participants randomized, 31 completed the 12-week treatment period. There are two early withdrawals, one from placebo and one from the 40 milligrams dose group. Also, one U.S. patient had to discontinue the study due to the clinical hold. Demographics and the baseline characteristics were generally balanced across treatment arms in this study. Participants with various disease activities were well represented in each treatment group. In general, the mean baseline disease attack rate is slightly higher in the deucrictibant treatment groups. For the primary endpoint, compared to placebo, deucrictibant significantly reduced the monthly rate of investigator-confirmed attacks by 84.5%. In addition, median attack rate treated with deucrictibant also reduced from baseline close to 100%. If further demonstrated in the pivotal trial, this data could position deucrictibant to be on par with the approved injectable prophylactic treatments. Here is the burst-on-wire plot. It represents individual patient data, for example, attack occurrence, duration, severity, and also use of on-demand medication during the 12-week treatment period. The placebo group on top, 20 milligram dose group in the middle, and the bottom is a 40 milligram dose group. From the graph, it is clearly noted there are many more attacks reported in the placebo group, especially severe attack, highlighted by the red box. Here, we can tell about half of the placebo patients have at least one severe attack observed during the study period. Compared to the placebo group, there is no any severe attack observed in either 20 milligram or 40 milligram deucrictibant treatment group. Additionally, the yellow dots indicate on-demand medication use in this study. We can tell on-demand treatment was substantially reduced in both deucrictibant treatment arm. This graph in the slides zoom in on the reduction in the moderate and severe attacks. Deucrictibant 40 milligram group demonstrate 92.3% reduction in the moderate or severe attacks. As highlighted before, there are no any severe attack in either deucrictibant treatment group. Reducing attack frequency is important, but so is a reduced need for on-demand medication. As seen from this graph, 40 milligram dose deucrictibant shows a 92.6% reduction in attacks treated with on-demand medication, indicate with the deucrictibant treatment, the use of on-demand or rescue medication is virtually diminished. In addition, we also look at the achievement of different thresholds of attack reduction from the baseline. About 80%-90% deucrictibant-treated patients achieved at least 50% or 70% reduction from the baseline. 60% deucrictibant treatment patients have at least 90% reduction from the baseline, and almost half of the patients treated with deucrictibant were attack-free for the entire 12-week treatment period. The last efficacy point we would like to share is the impact of baseline attack rate on the attack reduction. Despite a small sample size in each subgroup, from the graph, we can tell that deucrictibant is consistently effective in the prevention of attacks, regardless of more or less baseline attack rate. Consistent with efficacy outcomes, patient global assessment of change also shows a substantial improvement with deucrictibant treatments. In the 40 milligram dose group, all participants experienced a meaningful improvement, approximately 80% of patients indicating much better at the end of study. AECOL, Angioedema Quality of Life, is a health-related quality of life questionnaire validated for use in HAE patients. In total, 17 items are assessed in four domains: fears and shame, functioning, fatigue, mood, and nutrition. Higher score indicating more severe impact of quality of life from HAE disease. Lower score indicates the improvement. If we focus on 40 milligram group, the dashed line indicating patient's assessment at baseline and the solid line for assessment at week 12. As clearly shown in the graph, the evident decrease in the area of the spider plot at the week 12 represents the treatment with deucrictibant has a clinically meaningful improvement in all domains of the AECOL, especially the two highly impactful domains for patients' quality of life, fear and shame, and functioning. For the safety profile, throughout 12 weeks of treatment in Chapter 1, both doses of deucrictibant were well tolerated. The incidence of total adverse events is comparable between deucrictibant and the placebo treatments. There were no serious adverse events, no severe treatment-related events, and no adverse events leading to discontinuation from study. Also, no clinically significant abnormal trend of lab vital signs or ECG parameters. In total of the study, four treatment-related adverse events observed. All of them are mild in severity. One patient reported headache from the placebo group, one patient with one event nausea, and one patient with one event of dizziness in the 20 milligram group, and one patient with one event of GGT elevation in the 40 milligram group. In summary, the Chapter 1 study for the first time demonstrates that antagonism of bradykinin B2 receptor can provide early and sustained protection from HAE attacks and support further development of deucrictibant as a prophylactic therapy. If further confirmed in the pivotal studies, deucrictibant could be the first HAE treatment to combine injectable-like efficacy, favorable safety profile, and the compelling convenience as an oral treatment. Now, I would like to hand over to Professor Riedl to share his perspective as a treating physician and also principal investigator for Chapter 1 study. Thank you, Professor Riedl.
Thanks, Dr. Liu. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with all of you this morning and discuss the data. You've just seen the data, so I'm not going to spend time rehashing that, but I would like to spend a couple of minutes giving, I guess, perspective of a treating specialist who cares for a large group of patients with hereditary angioedema. As everyone on the call likely knows, there have been significant advances in the treatment of HAE really since around 2008, 2009, with the development of targeted therapies for hereditary angioedema, where prior we had really very little to offer these patients. And I think the data that you've just seen represents another significant step forward in the evolution of treatment that we've seen for HAE in the past 10 or 15 years. There has been a clear move towards prophylactic treatments in the HAE management space, depending on data set that you look at, somewhere between 60 and 85% of patients move towards long-term prophylactic therapy, and certainly in my practice, the majority of patients are interested in long-term prophylactic therapy. Doesn't mean that 100% of them go on it, but we certainly discuss it increasingly in clinical practice. And so I think this step ahead with deucrictibant, again, represents an effort to really look at an effective, safe, and tolerable long-term prophylactic treatment, which is really the questions we get from patients. How well is this going to work? Is it safe for me to take? And can I adhere to the treatment? And that last piece is important because there has been increasing questions and interest from both patients and clinicians in oral treatments for hereditary angioedema. Of course, we've seen some development and we have an approved oral medicine for HAE, but ongoing interest for ways to make that more effective, more tolerable, and certainly safety is important. So I think that as a prescriber, as a treating specialist, we're very interested in this data set as a way to push forward for an effective oral option to prevent attacks. I think you've seen that the efficacy looks very promising. As was noted, we don't have head-to-head studies, and I don't like comparing agents where we don't have head-to-head studies, but certainly the efficacy meets the primary endpoint and is in the ballpark of what we see with the very effective injected therapies, IV and sub-Q therapies currently used to manage HAE. So obviously all the limitations of a relatively small phase 2 study, but so far looks very promising in terms of how well this works. I would just make a couple of comments as a clinical investigator, something that I'm interested in seeing in these studies. Number one is, the reduction in on-demand medications. This is very important, not only to patients and to me as a treater, but to payers. They like to see that if we are truly preventing attacks with a reduction in the need for rescue or on-demand HAE meds. So I think that's not a primary endpoint, but I think an important one for us clinically. A couple of other things I think that are very important. This treatment looks to be so far highly effective, even in our most severely affected patients. You saw the data on patients enrolled that had two or more attacks per month. That's a pretty severe HAE patient. And again, so far in this phase 2 study, it looks like this therapy is effective even in that severely affected subpopulation. I would also say that we're very interested in attack-free status. This is a term that's used more and more as we talk to patients. What are the chances that a patient will stop having attacks entirely? And again, small data set, but you saw that that nearly half of the patients were attack-free during this study period, and more than well over 50% had a greater than 90% attack rate. So this is something we'll look forward to seeing in larger, longer studies, but I think an increasingly important endpoint that we're paying attention to with the development of these therapeutics. And lastly, I would just mention, draw your attention to quality of life. I know this is a little bit of a soft endpoint, but it is very important, and a lot of emphasis now being put on quality of life measurements in HAE treatment. And you saw the AE-QOL data, which is sort of the standard tool that's been used in studies for HAE therapeutics. And it's very clear from the data set that patients on deucrictibant did report a significant improvement in their quality of life. For me personally, the functional domain is the really important one. That's what measures people's ability to work and go to school and be with their families and travel and exercise and do all the things that we want to do as humans. So I think that's important. It's not the primary endpoint, but it's a very important that we see that data, that people are improved in their quality of life, their functioning, and their activities. So I was very pleased to see that incorporated and see the outcome there. So I think I'll pause there. I guess one last comment. I think safety is obviously paramount as well. And again, we'll need a bigger, longer study on safety and tolerability, but very reassuring to see there really wasn't any major concerns, certainly no serious adverse events, and you heard about the few adverse events reported in a few patients, but I think that that also is reassuring to me that it certainly looks promising and is worth moving ahead with investigating this treatment for HAE. So thanks for the opportunity to provide a little perspective, and I'll turn it back over to the moderators.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Riedl, for your kind words and great insight. In addition to these exciting data presented today, we're pleased to announce that Pharvaris completed the 26-week rodent toxicology study requested by the FDA, which we believe met its objective. We're preparing to submit the study results to the FDA by the end of the year for their review. Our product strategy is to develop two formulations with the same active ingredient, deucrictibant. These data from Chapter 1, together with the compelling data from our RAPIDe-1 study for on-demand treatments, support the potential for deucrictibant to be preferred option for both prevent and to treat attacks. Before opening up the line for questions, I'd like to recognize that this is a pivotal moment for the HAE community and for our company, and we remain tenacious in our commitment to pioneer science for patient choice. Over to the operator.
Thank you. This has now concluded the presentation section of the webcast, and we will now open the Q&A portion of the call. As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 and 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. To withdraw your question, please press star 1 and 1 again. Once again, please press star 1 and 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Thank you. We are now going to proceed with our first question. And the questions come from the line of Joseph Schwartz from Leerink. Please ask a question. Your line is opened.
Great. Thanks very much. And congratulations on the fantastic outcome here. I was wondering how you're thinking about the dosing going forward with respect to the extended release tablet. Are you able to learn much from the PK in the trial? I know that you're going forward with 40 mgs in the OLE. So is that the go-forward dose? Do you think that will translate nicely into the extended-release tablet? And do you need any additional bridging work? And then I have a follow-up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Joe, for the question. So we are, this is the top-line data and the analysis, and the further analysis of the data is ongoing. So I let Pong comment on that further. And the intention on the extended release tablet is we are not planning any particular bridging studies. We plan to go directly into to phase 3 with that formulation. But I ask Pong to comment also on the PK.
Yes, thanks, Bernd. Excellent question. From the Chapter 1 study, we do see that both those regimens were significantly effective. Meanwhile, from the totality of the data, we indeed consider 40 milligrams per day dose regimen provide numerically higher efficacy. As Bernd mentioned, that currently team has already developed the XR extend release formulation, and we would consider that with the extend formulation here, it not only provide once daily treatment, potentially further improve compliance, also that the trough level with extended release formulation potentially can be even higher compared to the 20 milligram BID or 40 milligram per day we used in the Chapter 1 study. Therefore, as Bernd mentioned, currently the team work hard toward to consider to include that extended release formulation 40 milligram maybe in potentially in the future Chapter 1 study, and we would expect it to provide potentially even better efficacy and compliance.
Great, thank you. And then for follow-up, I know that you can't get a end of phase 2 meeting with the FDA until you get off of clinical hold. So I was just wondering about your strategy, given you'll also likely be including ex-US sites and they haven't had any issues preclinical safety. So I was wondering, are you planning to include the Chapter 1 data to the FDA? Do you think that would help your case, given the safety profile looks very clean? Was the FDA interested in seeing this? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I mean, as we mentioned, we completed a 26-week rodent study requested by the FDA and preparing the study results by the end of the year, so that is the focus of the FDA review.
Does that answer your question, Joseph?
Yeah, I guess, you know, what if you just talk a little bit more about the strategy, will you be, are you absolutely waiting to get off of hold before you advance the phase three outside the U.S.? Do you think you need to harmonize between the FDA and other rest of world regulatory agencies, or could you get any?
Yeah, I mean, the work, yeah, that's great. Great question, Joe. So we are, of course, already now starting the preparations to launch the phase three program for prophylactic, and as we're going through the usual steps in preparing for such a study over the coming period and months of next year. And in parallel, of course, committed to work with the FDA regarding the clinical hold. And so to that extent, the discussion with the FDA is not necessarily a gating item in that process. And I think the protocol for a prophylactic study, in contrast to the on-demand studies, is relatively straightforward. So I think we are able to keep our momentum.
Very helpful. Thanks for taking my questions.
Yeah.
Thank you. We are now going to take our next question. And the questions come from the line of Justin Kim from Oppenheimer. Please ask your question. Your line is opened.
Hi, good morning, and congrats on the results. I have maybe two questions, one for Dr. Riedel and one for the company. Maybe just first for Dr. Riedel, you know, based on what we know about sort of the risk-benefit profile with deucrictibant, could you just comment for us sort of what an effective oral with this type of profile might sort of first be used in, and how in your practice? Now, are there certain patients that you think are going to be sort of best adopters, switchers of prophylaxis? You know, what types of modalities these patients might be on versus sort of any patient? Any sort of initial thoughts there, you know, appreciating that these are initial and somewhat early results? Thanks.
Sure, I'll try to address the question. I mean, I think clinical decision making is always a little tricky because, as people probably know, this is a highly variable condition, both in terms of the frequency of attacks, the types of attacks, how it affects individuals, and so it is really quite individualized, which makes it hard to sort of give examples of specific groups of patients that are interested in a given therapy. What I can say, though, is that there still is it's a relatively small group still on the sidelines, just using on-demand treatments that just haven't been enamored with the current therapies, and a lot of that has to do with either route of administration or side effect profile of the current treatments that are out there. So I do think that I'm sort of looking into the future here without knowing the results, but if this were to hold true that deucrictibant is, you know, safe and effective, there will be patients that this becomes their, you know, their first foray into long-term prophylaxis because this may fit a profile that they've kind of been waiting for. That said, there's probably a slightly larger group that are already on long-term prophylaxis, but are perhaps not totally satisfied with their current treatment. Much of that has to do with tolerability. We have very, you know, effective treatments, but the majority of them are injections or infusions, and that does wear on people over time as a lifelong chronic therapy. So I think with the oral option we have currently, it's been extremely helpful for some patients, but there has been some variability in the response to that agent. And so I think if we had perhaps a more effective, a proven oral therapy with greater efficacy, you would certainly see some shift from the existing treatments towards that therapy, in this case, you know, potentially deucrictibant. So I think those are kind of the two groups, new to prophy, and then There are people that are sort of looking for the next, you know, the next more tolerable but very effective treatment, which could potentially be this agent. So I hope that addresses your question. It's a little tricky to sort of group patients in that fashion, but we certainly are having those discussions with our patients.
Great, great. Understood. And maybe just one for the team. I know that sort of the work is sort of ongoing and the study's just sort of been completed on the 26-week rodent study, but could you just comment any further on sort of what features there specifically give the team confidence on it meeting its objective? Any color would be helpful. Great. Thank you.
Could you maybe repeat that to meet its what objective?
Any additional color as to like what gives the team confidence, in terms of like were there any specific areas, like what the goal of the 26-week toxicology rodent study was and kind of like maybe any color as to meeting that goal, beyond sort of what was in the press release?
Yeah, we have not commented previously on the nature concern on from the FDA, and it was designed to provide more data as aligned discussions with the FDA for their review, and the study we believe met its objective in generating that data, and the nature and timing response from FDA is of course uncertain, but that we will be submitting it by the end of the year for them to review.
Okay, understood. Great. Thanks so much, and congrats again.
Thank you. We are now going to proceed with our next question. And the question comes from the line of John Wolpen from JMP. Please ask your question. Your line is opened.
Hey, just wanted to share my congrats. Very impressive data. A couple on trial, conduct and then a follow-up. Just wondering, can you talk a little bit about the geographic distribution in the trial and if there's any difference in management, and then how attacks are adjudicated during the study?
Yeah, thanks, John. That's a great question. I'll hand over to Peng to give you some more color on that.
Sure. Yeah, excellent question. Regarding for the geography, that as mentioned during the presentation, altogether the 34 patients were enrolled from the 9 different European countries and also North American countries, including 3 patients from U.S. and several patients from Canada. And regarding the attacks reported in the study, all the attacks are investigator-confirmed attack. That means the patient will report that all the attack information to investigators within 72 hours of the attack period. Then the investigator will talk to the patient and assess whether it's a truly HE attack or not.
That's helpful. So you had 2 patients from the U.S. that completed prior to the clinical hold. Is that correct?
That's correct. That the 2 U.S. patients completed part 1, that 12-week treatment period, then roll over to the open-label extension study, and the 1 U.S. patient discontinued earlier in the 12-week treatment period.
Got it. Okay. And then just a question for Dr. Riedel, if I can. Just wondering, we've seen patients move from their new therapies as they become introduced to the market with better profiles, but what's driving patients from switching from therapies today? Is it if they're still having breakthrough attacks or, more convenience, and how sticky are the therapies getting these days that people are having years and years of experience on them?
Yeah, good question. Again, it's variable, but what we are seeing, not surprisingly, is sort of efficacy, which, still carries the day most of the time. Patients want their treatment to be effective. And as far as stickiness, that really has been, I think, the major driver that, that this medicine keeps me from swelling and I go long stretches without having any attacks. So that's why I think, the efficacy data, of course, is always perhaps the most important with safety right there, because efficacy still is at the very top of our minds and conversations for both docs and patients. But the other piece that's driving is, I guess, what I would call tolerability or burden of treatment. So, you know, we haven't seen major safety signals for the most part across these HAE therapies, which is wonderful, and we always are watchful for any issues. But tolerability and burden of treatment are a little bit different, and that's obviously the ability of people to adhere to the treatment for long periods of time and it not be terribly disruptive to their schedules, and you know, they're not dreading doing the treatment and those sorts of things. So that is part of what's driving, you know, continued patients continuing to look for additional options. There is a burden of treatment with some of the injectable medications, and we do hear about that. They'll do what they need to do, but given an alternative, and in particular, as I mentioned, interest in oral medicines, they'll take a hard look at that. And again, the efficacy piece has really, I think, kept people on some of the injected drugs to date. So I do think, you know, an oral medicine that shows really efficacy in the same ballpark as some of the IV or sub-Q drugs would really be attractive to patients. And, you know, we'll see obviously what happens moving forward with further studies. But I think that is a driving force for people, is what's going to be easiest and most tolerable for me to do as I look at, you know, being on treatment probably for years to manage my HAE.
Very helpful color. Thanks again, guys, and congrats.
Thank you. We are now going to take our next question. And the question has come from the line of Laura Chico from Wedbush. Please ask a question. Your line is opened.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I guess I wanted to ask one. The patient-level data you shared was particularly interesting. What did compliance look like in the study? And can you just remind us how that was evaluated over the 12 weeks? I guess I'm curious, for the few patients that did have attacks on treatment, was there any relationship to exposure? And then I have one quick follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Laura, for the question. Again, I'll throw it over to Peng to comment.
Yeah, thanks, Bern. Great question. As mentioned also that I just now answer another question here, the compliance for this study is generally quite good. And as mentioned for this study, that 40 milligram per day or, you know, 20 milligram per day is still twice daily treatment. That's why we mentioned that for the future pivotal study, we expect once daily treatment with extended release formulation, and the compliance can be even be boosted. Regarding for the exposure level for a few patients there, because currently we only have top line data, we don't have the exposure data for the patient yet. But you indeed mentioned a very good point. We will go back to check how about the exposure level for a few patients, especially for medium dose group. And also these patients will roll over from medium dose group to the 40 milligram dose group in the open label extension study. And we will continue monitor whether the response can be even better in the open label extension study there.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. And then one follow-up question for Dr. Riedel. I think the fact that we're comparing this to injectables and not ORLADEYO is pretty striking, but I am curious, among your treated patients today, how much ORLADEYO usage do you have right now, and where has it been most useful, and what are some of the limitations? Thank you.
Sure, I can just, obviously, just my personal experience, so take it for that. Yeah, we certainly are using berotralstat or ORLADEYO, and in my mind, it really speaks to the appeal of oral therapy, because it is something that, you know, patients have come to us to talk about. They hear about it and they want to discuss it. And certainly, you know, we are prescribing it. We have a subset of patients on ORLADEYO. You know, the issue has mainly been there is, in my mind and in my experience, some variability in efficacy. And so it works really well for some patients and not as well for others. And so, you know, that was clear in the clinical trial. And we discussed that with patients when we're making decisions. So, as I mentioned before, I think that the major limitation has been concern from patients and, you know, and doctors about, is this going to work well for each and every patient? And that apparent efficacy difference, if you look at pivotal trials of the preventative drugs, has I think prevented some patients from, you know, from making a change. They wanted to their medication to work, and so when they look at the study data that we discuss, they do have concerns about whether the oral medicine will work as well for them. So I think mostly we've had people new to prophylaxis go on the existing oral therapy. We've had a handful of people switch from injectable drugs to the oral therapy, but that efficacy piece is something that's, you know, of concern to those of us having discussions and also to the patient. And so that's why, again, we don't have head-to-head studies. I'll just say it again. But based on this phase two data, you know, if we had an oral drug that was in the ballpark of the efficacy of the injectables, I think that would address one of the major factors we're sort of discussing when, you know, when looking at the treatment options.
Thanks very much.
This concludes our call. Thank you for joining us.